Thank you. Thank you. Sorry if I'm a bit croaky this morning. I think I did a lot of talking yesterday. So I'm going to give a shortish talk now about Göbekli Tepe and why it matters. And then I'm going to be joined on stage by Jimmy Corsetti of Bright Insight and Mike Collins of Wandering Wolf. They've both just returned from Göbekli Tepe, where they've seen outrageous things. And we're going to be talking about what's been happening there. But I'm going to set that up with this initial presentation about why I think Göbekli Tepe matters. And there it is before the recent roof covering, which has completely destroyed the atmosphere of the site. You can see the beauty and the majesty of it, this extraordinary megalithic site, which is 7,000 years older than Stonehenge, and which appears virtually out of nowhere with no obvious background, whereas Stonehenge has a very long, detailed background. And again, I showed this slide yesterday. I just want to pay tribute again to Klaus Schmidt, the late, great Klaus Schmidt, the kind of archaeologist I wish there were more of them in the world. He was such a good man, so open-hearted and so passionate about his subject. And it's shameful the way his successors are trying to undo every aspect of his work. This is the Istanbul Chronicle, and Klaus Schmidt's wife is quoted in here because she's horrified by what's happening as well. The Istanbul Chronicle wants to be accessible to everyone, provide readers with news that's objective, clear, and unbiased. Basically, after Klaus Schmidt's passing in 2014, excavation efforts at Göbekli Tepe stopped. And then in 2016, project management was transferred to the Dogus Group, a prominent Turkish conglomerate. And we'll go into the implications of that. But a couple of remarks from Klaus Schmidt's widow. She's also an archaeologist. She visits Göbekli Tepe annually. She was shocked by the changes. She has described the situation as absurd and has shared unseen photos of the road construction on Instagram, sparking further conflict among the archaeological community. In the light of these developments, the site's official opening date for tourism has been announced. This announcement symbolizes how the government's intention with Göbekli Tepe is fully economic, meaning no archaeological development is intended for any time soon, raising concerns in the archaeology community. And then shortly after, Klaus Schwab, founder and executive chairman of the World Economic Forum, made a statement declaring that the Göbekli Tepe excavation has been left for future generations. The most important archaeological site in the world is no longer going to be excavated. It's been left for future generations. And this statement has been interpreted by some, including me, as an admission of the cessation of ongoing archaeological work. So critics question how the Dogus Group has been given such privileges in the light of the stopped excavations and the alleged damage to the site. Ultimately, since 2016, all excavation work at Göbekli Tepe, a site of extreme historical significance, has reportedly been stopped. We've got the roof over the site. We have this whole problem with trees. And thank you to Jimmy Corsetti for drawing attention to the issue of the trees, those olive trees parked. We know that there are hundreds more megalithic pillars under the ground and huge circles of them under the ground which have never been excavated. And those trees were planted directly on top of precious archaeological sites with their roots going down into the archaeological sites and destroying them. And that would have carried on if Jimmy Corsetti had not drawn attention to this. When he drew attention, when Jimmy drew attention to the harm being done by these bloody trees, he was initially attacked by the archaeological community who tried to calm our fears and say, there's no problem with the trees. They're not going to do any damage. But as the pressure continued and as the exposure of what's happening at Göbekli Tepe continued, suddenly, one day, they cut down all the trees. Yeah, it shows the pressure works. It shows the pressure works. It shows we have to keep our eye on them. We need to be watching them and what they're doing with our collective heritage. Again, I'm there with Klaus Schmidt. Get a sense of the scale and the beauty of the site. This is the quarry. The large megaliths at Göbekli Tepe were not transported large, immense distances. Majority were quarried within 100 meters or so of the main stone circles. This is a pillar, very large, probably 50-ton T-shaped pillar, But they never continued quarrying it out because a fault was, actually multiple faults were discovered in the rock. And you can see these interesting carvings that we find all over the site. This is particularly intriguing. I find this icon of a human figure. This is an anthropomorphic figure. We don't see a fully developed head, but the T-shaped, the T at the top represents the head of the individual, and then the individual has arms, and the hands meet just above the belt, around the navel. And that posture is actually reflected in iconography all around the world. It's a very curious thing, these so-called navel idols that are found everywhere. And of course, this is high relief. You can see that to create those fingers, that the arms, the belt, they've had to cut away all the stone around it. This is very, very, very highly technical, beautiful work of sculpture. And now, covered with this monstrosity, turned tamed, this is what happens when archaeology gives way to tourism, that the site becomes tame. It becomes a sort of Disneyland. It becomes an exhibit. It no longer becomes a thing in itself from which we can learn. You can see what Göbekli Tepe is, and you can do so without the rain pouring on you, I suppose. But I don't like this covering at all. I think it's very ugly and very unhelpful. And I'm so glad I was able to see and get to know the site before that happened. This shot, because the moon is in the shot, and this reminds us that for the people of Göbekli Tepe, the skies were very important. The skies were what it's all about. Everything was about astronomical, solar, and lunar alignments at Göbekli Tepe. So what this cover has done is it's disconnected Göbekli Tepe from the universe. This is a site that was meant to be connected to the universe now that it's been opened up, and it's been disconnected. Giulio Magli, a great archaeo astronomer. He's studied the alignments at Göbekli Tepe, he's noting that the alignment to Sirius and the changing positions of Sirius within the site is extremely, extremely powerful and absolutely beyond dispute. Göbekli Tepe isn't alone. We first went there in 2013, Santa and I. 2014, we went to Karahan Tepe. That's what Karahan Tepe looked like in 2014. A few T-shaped pillars sticking out the side of the hill. It's now been excavated, and this is an amazing enclosure at Karahan Tepe. I'm particularly struck by that stone face. Nekmi Karul, who I interviewed in Ancient Apocalypse and seemed to be quite helpful, subsequently has been undoubtedly approached by Flint Dibble and others and now has nothing to say about me but negative things. But nevertheless, he appeared on the show with me. We think that this is a snake-like head. It's a snake form with a human head that's emerging from the rock there. Karahan Tepe is now about to have a roof covering also, and work is already underway, as Jimmy and Mike have observed, to drill down into the site and destroy the site in order to make it a tourist attraction. Just a map of the whole region. We have to understand now, Göbekli Tepe is not alone. The Turkish archaeologists are right when they talk about the Tas Tepe civilization, the Stone Hills civilization. There's an emergence all around Göbekli Tepe of sites that date back to that same horizon about 12,000 years ago. And not just Göbekli Tepe, that same culture is found over on Cyprus. That means we're dealing with people who were navigators and seafarers. Cyprus was always an island, even at the peak of the last ice age. It's surrounded by great deeps, and down into the Jordan Valley as well. And Abu Huraira, as I showed you yesterday, is one of the sites that's been identified as a site of a massive airburst from the disintegrating Younger Dryas comet. That's the report on Abu Huraira and how close it is to Göbekli Tepe. And if we look at Göbekli Tepe, we can see that it is situated between the headwaters of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. What does Mesopotamia mean? It means between the rivers. Göbekli Tepe is sitting right there, up above where the supposed first, earliest ever human civilization appeared, the civilization of Sumer. I cannot accept that the development of Sumerian civilization is disconnected from what happened at Göbekli Tepe. There is a connection, I'm sure of it, but it's deeply hidden and hard to see sometimes. There's the artist's impression of that airburst over Abu Huraira, and Martin Sweatman has published a book, Prehistory Decoded, where he believes that Pillar 43 in Enclosure D at Göbekli Tepe is a calendar which commemorates the date of the Younger Dryas impact. It's a complicated issue. I'm going to get into this in more depth. Prominently involving the constellation that we know today as Sagittarius, the alignment, you can see Sagittarius there. Do you see that thing that looks a bit like a teapot? Spout of the teapot? That's Sagittarius. And we argue that the vulture on Pillar 43 represents Sagittarius, the constellation we call Sagittarius, and that this is the sun poised over the wing or the arrow of Sagittarius. The location of the sun when it's there over Sagittarius on a solstice, this happens twice in 26,000 years. Once on the summer solstice and once on the winter solstice. And those two happenings are separated by 12,500 years, half a cycle of precession. So the alignment of the sun over the constellation we call Sagittarius with the center of the Milky Way galaxy, that did occur at the summer solstice 12,800 years ago. But it also occurs at the winter solstice in our time today. The same alignment occurs 12,500 years later, half a precessional cycle later. And so the one occurrence was on the summer solstice around 12,800 years ago. And the most recent still ongoing is the winter solstice in our present epoch. So I'm there with Martin. That isn't Göbekli Tepe, that's a model of Göbekli Tepe in one of the major museums at the nearby town of Şanlıurfa. And we're talking about the imagery on Pillar 43. The airburst over Abu Huraira, so close to Göbekli Tepe, would have been a massive regional phenomenon, remembered for centuries. On the basis of this and much other evidence, Sweatman concludes that the imagery of Pillar 43 is an astronomical diagram featuring constellation figures with the summer solstice sun located just above the spout of the asterism figured by the astronomers of Göbekli Tepe as a vulture with outstretched wings and nominated by modern astronomers as the teapot of Sagittarius. As such, the pillar serves as a date stamp for the epoch of the Younger Dryas impacts some 12,800 years ago. But the story doesn't really begin with Martin's 2019 book. The story begins earlier. It begins in 2013 with an article that I accepted for publication on my website by a remarkably insightful individual called Paul Burley. And actually, Paul was the first to notice the curious nature of the figures on Pillar 43 and to tie them up with the center of the galaxy and Sagittarius. And from the very beginning, Paul, in his work, was looking at the winter solstice moment when the sun aligns through Sagittarius with the center of the galaxy. In fact, what he argued was that that pillar at Göbekli Tepe had been carved to forewarn of a future time, the next time that there would be a solstice alignment. And again, these are some of Paul's arguments. The similarity of the bas relief to the crossing of the ecliptic and galactic equator at the center of the Milky Way is difficult to reject, supporting the possibility that humans recognized and documented the precession of the equinoxes thousands of years earlier than is generally accepted by scholars at this time. And what's important here is that for some unknown reason, the builders of Göbekli Tepe constructed a temple apparently highlighting a time 11,600 years in their future. So this also ties up Paul's work, arguing that what we're looking at is the winter solstice alignment occurring in our time. Weirdly, that's exactly the same argument about precession that John Major Jenkins made concerning the Mayan calendar. The Mayan calendar is keyed to that same moment, the winter solstice, when the sun aligns through Sagittarius directly with the center of the galaxy. That defines the date of 2012. And as I explained yesterday, it's not an instant, it's a window, several decades wide. So what Paul Burley recognized in Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe is exactly what John Major Jenkins recognized concerning the Mayan calendar. These two issues are not disconnected. They're closely connected, and they're connected by the phenomenon of precession. It's the cosmic rebirth of the sun from the womb of the galaxy, the dark rift at the galactic center. The former world age ends. The new world age begins. So here's the, as I said, it's complicated. Both Swetman and Burley accept the well-established radiocarbon date of 9,600 BC, roughly 11,600 years ago, for enclosure D, and therefore for pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe. In summary, Swetman argues that the pillar was carved to record and commemorate the airburst over Abu Huraira that had occurred 1,200 years earlier than the creation of Göbekli Tepe. It thus serves as a date stamp for the onset of the Younger Dryas epoch 12,800 years ago, when the summer solstice sun stood on the wing of the vulture, Sagittarius teapot, in alignment with the galactic center. On the other hand, for Burley, the ancient astronomers of Göbekli Tepe 11,600 years ago focused not on the summer solstice sun, but on the winter solstice sun. On his analysis, therefore, the imagery of Pillar 43 results from forward precessional calculations, much like those of the ancient Maya with their 2012 date of creation, and depicts the sky of our own time. What if both are right? What if that pillar actually does commemorate the 12,800-year-ago event and does contain a message for the future? What if Pillar 43 not only records and commemorates the Abu Huraira airburst at the onset of the Younger Dryas, but also uses the universal astronomical language of precession to carry a message to the future, a forewarning? If you want to send a message to the future, for goodness sake, don't write it down in a script. Because 10,000 years from now, the chances are nobody's going to be able to read that script or ever have any hope of deciphering it, as is presently the case with the Indus Valley script and the Easter Island script. If you want to send a message to the future, use a universal language. Use the language of astronomy and combine it with permanent megalithic architecture, which is hard to destroy. And then you have a message that any culture in the future that is astronomically literate will be able to interpret. So maybe the message is, when next you see the sun in direct alignment with the dark rift at a solstice, beware. Either way, we're dealing with the handiwork of master astronomers at Göbekli Tepe. Again, I talked about Mesopotamia, the location of Göbekli Tepe, and the Taz Tepeler civilization and the connection with Mesopotamia. And it's intriguing that Mesopotamia, ancient Sumer, has this tradition of a great flood, destroyed the world, pushed humanity back to a rudimentary state, but there were some who survived the flood who had knowledge, and they went around the world and they tried to restore the lost world. They tried to bring the lost world back. And in ancient Mesopotamia, this was Oannes, a figure who supposedly emerged from the sea, and the seven sages. And they brought wisdom to Sumer, which formed the basis of the Sumerian civilization. It's interesting, I don't mean to be flippant, it's interesting how they carry these little handbags, all of them. We've talked about this quite a lot before. It's a curious thing. There are even physical models of them. They were remembered as teaching advanced astronomical and geodetic knowledge, including all the skills necessary for planning and setting out a city. So there's a figure of Oannes on the left there with his handbag. And on the other side of the world, in Mexico, at La Venta, we have this earliest representation of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent. You can see his plumed serpent on the top. He was also a civilization bringer in the memory of ancient Mexico. And look what the figure is holding in his hand. He's holding another one of those handbags. I mean, I don't know if there's anything to it, but I can't help looking at this and thinking there's something going on behind the scenes that we're not properly understanding yet. And of course, the handbags are there on Göbekli Tepe as well. They're there at the top of Pillar 43. And they carry on through time and in different locations. It's an idea that keeps passing through time. I think this is one of the problems with archaeology. I think we need an archaeology not just of things, not just of artifacts, not just of objects, but I think we need an archaeology of ideas as well. Ideas can be amongst the most enduring artifacts of human culture and can continue for thousands, perhaps even tens of thousands of years. Archaeology is neglecting the ideas of the ancients. So did the idea that there should be a scorpion and a bird in this region of the heavens persist for thousands of years, even while other figures changed their character and the notion of a centaur archer was introduced. And these are the depictions of Sagittarius. But notice he's got bird-like feet and a scorpion-like tail. So it's like this idea has kind of transmuted over time, but we can still see the origins of the idea in the later depictions of Mesopotamian Kuduru stones from the Babylonian period, 2nd millennium BC. Göbekli Tepe, founded 9,600 BC, it's a mysterious megalithic site, and it was, despite the protestations of those who are trying to ruin Klaus Schmidt's reputation, it was deliberately buried by its makers after 1,000 years of use and was not seen again until excavations by the German Archaeological Institute got underway in the 1990s. I just want to make another couple of small points. The T-shaped megaliths of Göbekli Tepe, we're looking at there. And then if we go to the island of Menorca, what do we see? We see more T-shaped megaliths. None of the megaliths on Menorca have been properly dated. It's very hard to date megaliths. I'm wondering whether the dating of the Menorca megaliths to about 4,000 years ago is wrong. I'm wondering whether the Menorca megaliths might be just as old as the Göbekli Tepe megaliths. The same kind of idea seems to be shared in both places. And then this kind of circular feel of Göbekli Tepe, and I find myself looking at the temples of Malta, supposedly dated to the oldest Gigantea about 6,000 years ago, the youngest about 4,500 years ago. But again, the dating of the Maltese temples is flimsy. It's based on almost nothing. There are no intact carbon dates from beneath megaliths in the great megalithic temples. They've got some carbon dates at Gigantea, but they're from 40 meters away from the main temple. And they're underneath what was formerly a toilet block for tourists. They've now been excavated, but it's 40 meters away from the temple. That can't tell us the date of the temple at all. I'm wondering if the Maltese temples are much older. I first made this point in season one of Ancient Apocalypse. I'm wondering if the Maltese temples have been significantly misdated. And then in the Sicily Channel, you know, Sicily used to be joined to Malta by a land bridge when sea levels were lower during the Ice Age. And in the Sicily Channel, they found this huge megalith at the bottom with holes drilled through it. It's clearly man-made. Underwater between Sicily and the Maltese archipelago, I think much more research needs to be done. I think there may be further examples of this kind of megalithic architecture down there. So again, we're looking at the Tas Tepler civilization. The areas, we can speak of it from the areas that have been extensively investigated. As I say, Cyprus is very interesting. Then there's a lot in Israel, but that reflects actually the fact that there's a lot of archaeology being done in Israel. There's much less archaeology now being done up in Lebanon because the area is so devastated and so insecure. But Baalbek in Lebanon is a most extraordinary site, and I don't deny that large parts of it are Roman. This is definitely the Temple of Jupiter behind me, and behind that is the Temple of Bacchus, the god of wine, certainly Roman. But I wonder about the larger megaliths there, and this outer enclosure wall at Baalbek, the giant megaliths that we're looking at. This is the Trilithon. Each of these stones weighs 900 tons. And they're positioned about 25 feet above the ground. I'm just sitting on top of one of them there. And you can see that gap and these enormous 900-ton blocks. Looking up at them there, now there at my feet is the single piece of evidence that archaeologists point to say, no, those huge blocks were also put in place by the Romans. That single piece of evidence is definitely part of a Roman column, and it's down at the base of the wall. But let's think about this. This place was sometimes used as a fortress. This place was constantly attacked. Attackers undermine foundations to try and get underneath. I think we're looking at a repair block here, using Roman material on much older site. And of course, the extraordinary megalithic blocks still left in the quarry. Supposedly the Romans, although they could lift 900-ton blocks, 30 feet in the air, they couldn't lift 1,000-ton blocks, so they just did all the work on this and then just left it there in the quarry. The one I'm standing on weighs about 1,000 tons. This one across the road, now used as a rubbish tip, weighs 1,200 tons. And the new one discovered just at the bottom there, I'm standing on it, that one is 1,400 tons. And the argument is that the Romans did all this work to cut these out, but then just abandoned it. And I think that that's a very un-Roman thing to do. If they truly couldn't move the 1,000 or 1,200 ton blocks, they wouldn't have left them like that. They'd have sliced them up like loaves of bread, and they'd have used the smaller blocks that they created. They would have had use for them. It was a practical culture. They wouldn't have left them there. I think the whole quarry was completely covered by sediment during Roman times. I don't think the Romans even knew that this was there. So Göbekli Tepe raises huge questions over the origins of megalithic architecture, because we know for a fact that the initial inhabitants of Göbekli Tepe were not agriculturalists. They were hunter-foragers, hunter-gatherers. And it's been the dogma of archaeology for decades that hunter-gatherers couldn't create megaliths, that you needed a fully formed agricultural society generating surpluses in order to engage in megalithic construction. Well, Göbekli Tepe just blows that whole idea out of the water. It changes everything. And it is, and I say this with no intent of exaggeration, it is the single most important archaeological site in the world today. And it is shameful that this site is no longer going to be investigated. Karahan Tepe, there I am again. And I just want to compare that rock-hewn enclosure cut out of solid rock with the enclosure of the Great Sphinx. And when Mark Lehner said, show me a potsherd from a civilization 12,000 years ago, I would say Göbekli Tepe and Karahan Tepe are that quote-unquote potsherd. Now I'm going to ask Mike and Jimmy to join me in a second. I just want to finish with one other slide, which is this. I have very rarely serve as a host and speaker on tours. I haven't done for many years. But I've been asked next year, 2026, to host and lead and speak at a tour in Egypt. And I'm going to host and speak at tours in Turkey and in South America, Peru and Bolivia in 2027. So Egypt 2026, Peru and Bolivia 2027. If anybody's interested, you... Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. If you're interested, just go to the talks and events page of my website, and the full details of the company that are putting this together are there. I'm not involved in the administration of it. I'm going to be speaking and be the host. But I have worked with this company before, and they're good, they're efficient, they're decent people. I wouldn't be working with them otherwise. Okay, Mike and Jimmy, where are we?
Graham, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. So I think that neither Jimmy nor Mike need an introduction. You all know who they are. Jimmy is Bright Insight, and he's brought a whole new approach to looking at the problems of the past. And Mike Collins is just a masterful videographer. His channel, Wandering Wolf, records years of detailed, intense study of megalithic sites all around the world. Mike has really put in the legwork. He's seriously and deeply studied these sites, and I would urge everybody here, if you haven't subscribed to Jimmy's channel, please do. If you haven't subscribed to Mike's Wandering Wolf channel, please do. You'll not regret it. It's really worth looking at the work that these two guys are putting out.
Thank you, Graham.
Thank you, Graham. Okay.
So, I'll sit in the middle. Right, so how shall we begin? You've both just returned within a week or two from Göbekli Tepe, Karahan Tepe. You also went to Saybrook. Tell us about the trip. Tell us about why you made the trip and what the outcome was.
Graham, first, happy Easter, everybody. And I got to say that it is absolutely surreal to be here. About 10 years ago, I was watching Graham Hancock and Joe Rogan discuss Göbekli Tepe, which is how I first learned of the site. And so to be here now on stage with them discussing it is unbelievable, and I couldn't be more grateful.
Thank you.
Unreal.
Thank you.
And as far as our trip to Turkey, I would not have been able to be there if it wasn't for Mike Collins of Wandering Wolf, as well as Nikki from the Nikiana Jones podcast and her husband Joaquin. Thank you guys so much. And the timing of it, I consider divine, because for the fact that we were there when they were doing the last stages of tree removal, I can't wrap my head around just what are the odds of that, day of all days when they're just finishing it up. I don't know, it just feels like poetry in some way.
Yeah, absolutely. To see that, them removing the trees, the last of the trees there, and really the fruit of Jimmy's work.
Yeah, those trees would still be there if you hadn't drawn attention to this.
You know, this goes to show, in my first video on Göbekli Tepe, or I should say follow-up video, June of last year, at the very end of the video, I said, it will only be through the court of public opinion, that any meaningful changes would be possible. And sure enough, if you make a big stink online and something goes viral, you put the authorities in a position to where they have to respond. And it seems that the Turkish ministry is quite sensitive. And, you know, the fact that they had even allowed those trees to be planted in the first place. Let me first say that the planting of the trees themselves may have not been a conspiracy. The landowners were looking to increase the value of the land as the Turkish government was going to take it over. But that was a full 10 years after excavations had begun. And so it should not have been acceptable. It should have been tolerated for them to plant 1,000 olive trees on the site in the first place. They should have just compensated them. Because sure enough, you fast forward 20 plus years later and they confirmed that the roots were damaging the ruins. And how this all started is, you know, my first video on my channel, Bright Insight, was talking about Göbekli Tepe. And at that time, it was only 5% excavated. So I'm like, okay, let me put this on the back burner for a little bit. Let me let them do more excavations, and I'll circle back to this later. So last year, I'm like, hey, I haven't talked about Göbekli Tepe in a number of years. Let me just dive into it. And I was astonished to see that the percentage of excavations hadn't changed. They estimated it was somewhere between 5 and 10%. And I'm like, that's the same percentage that I heard Graham Hancock talk about it on Joe Rogan, you know, 8-9 years earlier. So I'm like, what is going on here? And then I start looking at the various aerial photographs of the site itself. Göbekli Tepe consists of approximately 22 acres. And I'm looking at them like, well, the portions that they've excavated is no more than just a few acres. So I'm looking at all these trees surrounding the entire site. And so I asked, and I worded it exactly like this in the video. Here is a very sincere question. Are any of these trees planted on top of ancient ruins? Well, that turned out to be true through a Dr. Dietrich who had physically excavated the site himself. And that showed two things. One, that there is no intention in the immediate future to actually excavate the site. And two, I thought that tree roots were notorious for damaging whatever lays below. They damage foundations of houses, sewer lines, and everything else. So that's kind of what led me down this path. And Mike, what are your thoughts?
Let's hear your take on this, Mike.
Yeah, you know, I've seen the damage that trees can do to sites around the world, and they can reduce an ancient structure to rubble within a generation or less. So, you know, this being done was hugely important for the site. And I think the big takeaway when we went there was it doesn't look like anything is... The focus is now on tourism and money.
Yeah.
And you get the sense of that as soon as you walk in.
Yeah.
And the roofing system that they've built is built directly into the site. So not only did we go see the trees, but making that discovery of these massive pylon steel beams that are they're going directly into the site.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about a major.
And you guys have shown this on both of your channels. We can see the damage very
penetrating
very
part of it. Some of those steel beams are piercing just feet. From pillar 43.
Yeah.
I mean, it's drilled right into the heart of the site.
Mm-hmm. It's appalling.
So we're talking about a major construction project there. So, you know, some of the flack that we got was for being too close to certain sites that we went to or this or that. We're talking about that roofing system. We're talking about a major construction site with people in the middle of the site.
Yeah.
So let's just be clear. These are day laborers.
Yeah.
So when they start building stuff like this, these aren't specialists or archaeologists.
No, not at all.
You know, they're construction crews and doing a massive project.
Yeah.
And so that's what we saw. And then it was reinforced by going to Karahan Tepe and being able to document there, which Jimmy's shown so well online and in his recent video, they're in the process of building that roofing system now, mm-hmm. and we were able to see the holes in the site there.
Yeah.
So we were able to get an idea of what they did to Göbekli Tepe, which are like 20-foot deep holes piercing directly into these sites.
Mm-hmm. To establish the infrastructure for the roof. They're now building, to anyone that's not familiar, you saw the roof, as Graham Hancock highlighted. They're building the same thing over Karan Tepe. They're in the initial stages of it. They just drug out approximately a dozen holes, as Mike said, 20 feet deep. And I kid you not, they drilled right into the heart of the unexcavation portions of the archaeological site itself. Who digs straight down 20 feet deep into unexcavated ruins? As I showed in my photos, which you can't see here, but if you were to look at my videos, there's the tops of unexcavated T-pillars just feet from these holes. And it's very clear that no archaeologists were involved in that. This is something that goes way above that. This is, you know, something that was established for the purposes of tourism revenue from the higher-ups. And it couldn't be more clear that they have no intention of fully excavating Karan Tepe or Göbekli Tepe. And I kid you not, go take look at the photos that we documented, and it's going to look exactly the same next year and the year after that. They have it in writing that they have scaled back large-scale excavations that they were doing in the years prior. And moving forward, they're going to focus on conservation and tourism. And then they've put that they've stated in writing that they intend to pass it down to, quote, future generations, with a 150-year estimate before it's completely excavated. Which means that nobody in here is going to be alive to see what's lying buried in Göbekli Tepe waiting to be discovered.
Yeah.
As Graham said, the most important site on Earth. The Göbekli Tepe purposely buried 11,600 years ago in the same time frame of the Younger Dryas climate catastrophe. It could be a time capsule of sorts. It could contain answers to whatever the cataclysm was. There, who knows what it is, but we're never going to know until we go dig it up. So it is completely inexcusable to not do this within our lifetimes. We have the means, money, and the motive to do so. It has nothing to do with money. As Graham mentioned, the Doges Group is funding it. They're a $1 billion conglomerate. No one, anyone within the managers of Göbekli Tepe have said anything about funding. And I point that out because that's the number one bit of pushback that I get. It's like, well, hey, listen, this costs money. Are you going to pay for it yourself? I'm like, it's not about money. And yeah, we could crowdfund it if we had to. People need to understand that most of these people digging out there are PhD students doing their field work. They're doing it for probably free or next to nothing, and they're getting their, you know, three squares a day and housing and room and board in order to put this on their thesis. So I don't know. I could go on and on. But
well, what I'm interested in is, you guys have brought attention to these disturbing matters. What has been the reaction of the archaeology community to you both? There has been some immediate reaction. Please, both of you, talk to me about this. Tell me what you've experienced as when you brought this to public attention. What happened?
I'm less used than some of getting, you know, mm-hmm. shit on online. And so thank God for guys like Jimmy and Dan and Sam. There you are. Who punch back.
Yeah.
Because it's brutal. Mm-hmm. And most of my videos up to this point have just been about trying to inspire people to go out and see this for themselves.
Yeah.
So the pushback has been pretty intense. And they're right now actively trying to rewrite the narrative mm-hmm. around this. They refuse to answer the questions that we raise about important issues like building directly into the heart of the site. They're trying to rewrite the narrative around the trees and push the date backs on those and say that there were already plans for this to happen. And Jimmy's been tackling that head on.
Yeah, they're saying that their site management plans have been in existence for years that articulated that they're going to remove the trees. That's not true. The only thing these site management plans state is that if the trees are ever an issue, they could be removed. There's nothing in there of any kind involving any type of date to remove the trees. And the reality is that I made my video on it in June of last year, and then the following month, Nekmi Karul, who Graham mentioned, who, by the way, had threatened to sanction me. And I'm like, sanction? What does that mean? Like, you're going to fine me, or are you talking about travel bans here? Because travel bans is typically what a sanction would most commonly involve. And so I'm like, hey, you know, when you get the most flack when you're over the target, as they say, you know, so I'm losing my train of thought. Where was I going with that? Oh, the pushback.
Yeah.
So basically what I'm seeing is that Jimmy Corsetti said, and so it's false. Jimmy Corsetti is not an archaeologist, yeah. So it's false. And I'm like, I'm sorry, I don't need a PhD in archaeology to understand that planting trees on top of precious ancient ruins is ridiculous. My girlfriend Brandy understands this. She's like, doesn't that destroy foundations of houses if you plant a tree too close? Because like her dad removed a tree, you know? Like, this is not rocket science, and you don't need a degree to understand it. I don't need a PhD to understand that excavating ancient ruins is what archaeologists are supposed to be doing for a living. I'm trying to give them a job here, and they're complaining about it. The reality is this. You won't find one single archaeologist that said anything about those trees planted over ruins at Göbekli Tepe. And not only that, the whole lineup of them, Flint Dibble, I have several tweets from him supporting and praising the trees, stating that it's going to preserve the soil and thus preserve the ruins. And I'm like, these ruins have been buried for 11,600 years and have been just fine. What are we talking about? Like, all those trees did was highlight that they had no plan to excavate those ruins within the foreseeable future. But now they remove them. And so basically they're trying to say that they were going to remove them anyways. That's not true. And the reality is that they got an incredible amount of pushback. It turns out that there's a lot of people within Turkey that have been dissatisfied with the lack of excavations there. I was unaware of this until I started scanning Google through Turkish headlines. And so they were very sensitive to it already. And so we basically lit a fire under their asses to realize that, like, hey, people are watching. And so now I'm going to put them on blast further. They have no business digging 20-foot deep holes in the middle of unexcavated ruins. It's very likely that they damaged some in the process. I believe that we witnessed that firsthand. They're already trying to deny it. In fact, there's a Dr. Hugh Thomas. I shouldn't even mention him. Bum. this guy is literally going on Twitter last night saying that these are nothing more than excavation trenches. Huh. I'm like, no, they're not. I was there, and the security from the Turkish ministry told us point blank that these holes are for the structure that's going to support the new roof. And not only that, it's prohibited to take photos or videos of those holes. He told us this directly. We had already taken the photos. He didn't realize it. But why would they go to the extent to create some kind of rule to prevent people from taking pictures of that? It's because they have something to hide.
Yeah, definitely.
They definitely, it's mob tactics, and it's personal. So when they attack, they don't address any of these issues.
That's right.
Or they skirt around it.
Yeah.
And everything becomes personal. If you get caught up into that,
yeah,
all of a sudden you become a target as
totally.
Well.
Totally. Yeah.
You know, and so it's just, it's an ugly scenario. It feels like kind of having just got sucked into all of this within the last 6 months or so.
Yeah.
It feels like there's something else here. It has nothing to do with archaeology. Mm. It's more about protecting ego, pride,
yeah,
a sense of importance.
Yeah.
And it genuinely feels like certain characters like Dibble are chasing fame.
Oh, yes.
rather than truth.
Absolutely. It's a parasitic chase for fame.
Right.
You find people who've already got some recognition, then you attack them. Yeah. And that way you get a bit of fame. Yeah, that's the way it works. Mike, tell me about yourself and about the origins of your channel. When did it begin? What's your intentions with the channel, and how far have you got in fulfilling those intentions?
I worked a job that I hated in sales, and I was going to take a year off.
Yeah,
I just decided that, you know, I hate doing this.
Yeah,
and I'd been into ancient history for so long, so I started traveling. The first place I went to was Sacsayhuaman. Mm-hmm. And as soon as I went there, I was just like, I don't know what I'm going to do, but I got to do this.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'm going to do it. So I just started recording stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, I think I was 35, so that was like 11 years ago.
Right.
And so I've just been learning as I go.
Tell us about some of the sites you've visited around the world.
I don't know.
Give us a few.
Mike has been to more sites than anyone besides Graham Hancock in this realm. Don't be bashful. He's probably been to 100 ancient sites around the world. I can't find anybody that's been to more sites than you other than Graham Hancock.
Yeah, several hundred, I think.
And you're doing this work with, I have to say, with great humility. You're not projecting any ego into this. You're just bringing information to the audience.
You know, when I was really inspired visiting these sites at what people are capable of. Mm. And I think it really inspired me to imagine what I might be capable of doing.
Yeah.
And I hope that by sharing stuff with people, it's just what I'm seeing and experiencing, that I might inspire other people to do a trip, go see a place, share it with people and connect. Mm-hmm. And it's been a fun ride,
And your site is an incredible resource for people who are interested in this. If I look at all the channels out there on the internet and I look at your channel, I believe your channel deserves 10 times the level of subscriptions it's got right now today.
Thank you.
Instantly, and 1,000 times more. It's an incredibly valuable channel.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And the same goes for you, Jimmy. You've been very good at managing the extraordinary weird environment of the internet, and you've somehow mastered how to deal with it. But at the same time, you're taking a lot of slings and arrows, and they hurt.
You know, I'll admit I can be sensitive sometimes to some of the criticism. Like, I've been called a Nazi. Mm-hmm. I've been called anti-Semitic. I've been called a white supremacist, and I'm like,
join the club.
And I'm like, this isn't something you say to people unless it was true. And this is nothing more than character assassination. But for me, I just have a little bit thicker skin. I'm just naturally a fighter. It's not that I'm a tough guy. It's just that if you push me, I'm going to punch you. And these people, they can't out-troll me. And, like, you know, I was a soldier. I did combat missions in Iraq. And, like, so when I look at some of these people making fun of me online, I'm like, these people don't scare me. I'm like, I've done something that was far more scary than anything they can lob at me. So I kind of laugh about it. I don't take it quite as seriously as some. And moments that there's some moments that I do. Some people can strike a nerve sometimes, because some people will try to really go out of their way to try to upset you. But to be honest with you, I'm one of these weirdos where the more pushback I get, it just emboldens me. Some of my best creativity and my line items of evidence that I'll present came from those moments when I was getting the most heat. For some reason, it just, my brain starts firing with ideas. And so they pick the wrong one, and I'm never going to stop. Like, I don't, what are they going to do? You know, and by the way, these people, Flint Dibble is trying to accuse Mike and I of breaking the law in Turkey for visiting the site of Cyborg, which is a sister site of Göbekli Tepe. They're trying to say that we trespassed. In fact, Flint Dibble went on a live stream just 3 days ago stating that I had jumped a fence and trespassed there. And I'm like, there is no fence. There is no sign. There is no barrier. It's on the side of the road in the middle of a neighborhood full of trash. There's dirty diapers in the site. Kids and farm animals roam in and out of it. I did not trespass. And even if I did, I don't care. I don't care. I tiptoed through that site. Nikki, Joaquin, Mike, you guys are witnesses. I was exceptionally careful. And so to accuse me of trespassing, and Mike, you should mention that you were planning on running a tour there with Nikki this November, and you had to cancel it because they're literally tagging the Turkish ministry to try to, like, lob accusations of illicit activity.
Yeah, I had to cancel my tour to Turkey for November because they've put it on blast so much and threatened me so much online.
Jesus.
So we lost about $6,000 on that.
Jeez.
Due to the pressure. That. I just couldn't, you know, we couldn't take the chance of risk it.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't want to go to a Turkish prison, guys.
No,
not as American.
No, I don't think
that'd
be fun.
That is not going to go well.
So it's very real, this protection of this narrative, or, you know, I don't even know what it is anymore. It doesn't even feel like a narrative. The narrative is whatever you, Jimmy, or anybody else says. They're just on the opposite side of that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, it's more of, you know, you can't even reason, and there's no polite conversation, and it just gets downright nasty. So,
yeah.
They're willing to attack you personally. They're willing to attack your means of living.
Yeah.
Your life. Your work.
Yeah.
There's no limits.
There's no limits.
No.
And I think we're dealing with people who so passionately and deeply believe that they're correct. They believe they have the monopoly on the truth. and they've earned that monopoly on the truth. And I think they do believe it's true. And because they believe it's true, they're prepared to use any methods to destroy those who disagree with them. Any methods at all. Doesn't matter if those methods are deeply underhand, if they're malicious, it doesn't matter. Whatever works to get rid of the person who's saying something different from what they say. And it's weird. Why should it be like that?
There seems to be a joy in it.
Yeah.
The laughing and like
getting, the constant mockery. Yes.
Yeah. You get a sense that this is enjoyable and fun.
For that lot, yeah.
They're getting a dopamine rush off of it, these trolls on the internet. Like, why else are they doing it? For a period of time, after Graham Hancock's Ancient Apocalypse Season 1 came out, I observed that Flint Dibble was on Twitter for approximately 18 hours a day. I'm not kidding.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, like, guys, I love this ancient history stuff, but 18 hours a day of getting angry on the internet, arguing about someone else's show, I want to be like, hey, Flint, if you have all the answers or you think that you can communicate ancient history better than Graham, go make your own fucking documentary.
Yeah.
Forgive me if there's any kids in the... sorry for the swearing. What's that?
Yeah. I realize that you're describing a religion on Easter Sunday.
And those on the other side of it. See, the skeptics, it almost feels like they're in a cult, to be honest with you. And when you criticize it, they get... visceral and toxic and nasty. But the reality is that the court of public opinion is on our side. And I would say that with the emergence of this alleged recent discovery underneath the Great Pyramid, with those scans that came out, whether that's true or not, that situation went ultra viral. That thing went so viral like nothing else I've seen in any recent times. And you know what that shows you? Is that the interest in lost ancient history as at an all-time high and is continuing to grow. Graham Hancock is proof of this. How many countries has your books sold in? Like Fingerprints of the Gods, do you have
I think it's 33 now.
Wow.
33 languages. And it's encouraging that Fingerprints was published in 1995. We're now in 2025, so we're talking 30... Are we talking 30 years? Yes.
Yeah.
The book is 30 years old. So I'm encouraged and strengthened by the fact that the book is still in print and is still being read by people. And my policy with books, obviously my ideas develop as time goes by, and I may change my mind on certain points of view, but when I've written a book, I never go back and interfere with the original text of that book. I leave it exactly as it was written, without a single change. If I'm going to bring out a new edition, what I may do is add an introduction and an epilogue, an afterword to the book, but I will never change the initial words. So, yes, I think I did make some mistakes in Fingerprints of the Gods, but I've tried to rectify those mistakes in future books to keep developing and learning, and I'm doing so because of my passion for the subject and because I believe it really matters. So to hear myself constantly referred to as a fraud, as a hoaxer, as a liar, when I've devoted my life to this, it's discouraging. It's deeply discouraging. And I think what they're trying to do is, if enough of these words are projected at the individuals that they don't like, they hope that some of them will stick, and that they can eventually get rid of those people. And my concern is that illusion that they're creating, this straw men that they're creating and that they then attack, that's what's going to go down in the historical record, not what really happened. And that is discouraging. But I'm enormously encouraged by the fact that we have many open-minded people, many of whom are sitting in this room today. Open-minded people who think for themselves, who are willing to take information from many different sources and come to their own conclusions about it. One of the things I detest about the archaeological regime at the moment is that they are really saying, you, the general public, you don't need to think. We'll do your thinking for you. Just listen to us. That's all you need to do. And if anybody else says anything different, that person is a liar and a hoaxer and a fraud.
Trust the experts.
Trust the experts, yeah. And my God, we live in a time when we need to not trust the experts. The experts themselves often don't know what they're doing. We've got to be our own leaders. We've got to stop being the led. We've got to be our own leaders and make our own decisions and not allow other people to decide for us. Yes, gather information from many different sources. Always make up your own mind. Don't let anybody else think for you.
And it's all the more reason why you need outside eyes to come in to see something new. There was this story I had heard when I was doing an internship that back in like late 2000, like 2008, 2010, Walmart was looking to greatly increase their online sales to compete with Amazon. And what they did was they hired an executive from Pepsi-Cola, which is far more than a soda company. They're a distributor more than anything else. And the story goes that on day one, this executive came in and saw some sort of opportunity for improvement that drastically changed the operations for Walmart that greatly increased their revenues and the online presence. So when I look at someone like Graham, because they'll say, oh, he's not an archaeologist. Jimmy Corsetti, my cons, they're not archaeologists. And it's like, where were the archaeologists to ask questions about the trees at Göbekli Tepe? It took an outsider. Like, I studied business and communications and sociology, and I have a minor in religious studies. But it proved that I don't need a degree in archaeology to understand that planting trees on top of 12,000-year-old ruins is weird and bizarre and makes no sense. And that's why, you know, having outside eyes, you can come in and see something, because these people go into, when they get their degrees, they get narrow-minded because they're, let's be real, they're required to memorize various textbooks, and so it can narrow your focus and distract you from the big picture. And so now more than ever, this field needs open-minded people.
Yeah. Guys, what's the way forward from here? And how can everybody in this room who would like to do so, how can we all help? What's the way forward?
Jimmy posted something wonderful the other day about an archaeological audit.
Yeah.
So if you're at a place, take pictures, take video, share it online. I think speaking out more and more.
Yeah.
There's, you know, tourism in itself isn't inherently bad.
Yeah.
But there used to be an overlap, and there's not anymore.
Yeah.
Archaeology goes up to a certain point.
Yeah.
And then it stops.
Yeah.
And it's all profit-focused after that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're losing our history.
Yeah.
For the pursuit of money.
Yeah.
And so, I don't know if you can go backwards, because the sides are too entrenched now.
Mm-hmm.
So it almost feels like something needs to be torn down to the studs and rebuilt.
And rebuilt, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea I had was doing archaeological audits. Every site you go to, take as many photos and videos as possible and post it online and let everyone go through it. And again, the court of public opinion, blasting things out. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. If it wasn't for the massive negative attention that they got involving those trees there, there's no doubt that those trees would still be there. The reality is that they just weren't monitoring the roots. They weren't. It's out of sight, out of mind, so to speak. They're focusing on everything else. But through the court of public opinion, that's the chance for any meaningful change, and it's been proven that it can be done and will be done again. And so the one thing I would say is that anytime you're having a conversation with anybody about Göbekli Tepe, you need to emphasize the point, which is that they have no intention to excavate it within any of our lifetimes. I'm going to keep saying it over and over and over and over again, because people need to understand that that is completely unacceptable. It makes no sense. This is 2025. Is this the world that we're choosing to live in? We're just not going to dig up the most important ancient sites? You know, they've even said that they're waiting for future technologies to develop before they continue to excavate it. And I'm like, what type of magical shovel or paintbrush or pressure hose are we talking about? We absolutely have the technological ability to unearth buried stones. That's gaslighting.
It is. Göbekli Tepe is part of the memory banks of mankind. And I use this phrase often, a species with amnesia. It's a subtitle in Fingerprints of the Gods. The original notion of what came from Immanuel Velikovsky, mankind in amnesia. No wonder we're a species with amnesia, with this kind of stuff going on, with this the way things go. We're literally closing down our memory banks. We don't want to remember that. We don't want to know about that. We just want to go this way. It's really, really, really wrong.
Much that once was is lost, for none now live who remember it. History became legend, legend became myth, and some things that should not have been forgotten were lost. You know what I'm quoting, right? Lord of the Rings,
yeah.
Opening monologue of Fellowship of the Ring. And it's true.
Yeah, absolutely true.